Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics? How's it going? It's Mark Maron. This is my show. Welcome to it. You're listening to WTF, the podcast. First of all, I'm doing more Trippany dates, more dates at the Trippany House at the Steve Allen Theater here in Los Angeles. I am doing the October 28th, November 11th, and November 18th. Jeff Tate will be opening for me tomorrow. Please come if you'd like to come. They've been fun shows, and it's $8, and it benefits the theater. You don't know what's going to happen, but I'm sure I'll make myself uncomfortable initially. Yesterday was football day. I did not partake in that. I have no problem any longer with anybody who enjoys football. Knock yourself out. Just don't fucking judge me. You know, like I tweeted, I said, look, I hope you enjoy football. I don't know how to. And some guys like, you hipsters, none of you like football. I haven't liked football my whole life. Never call myself a hipster. I'm a grown-ass man. And I don't like sports. It's not a matter of me judging you any longer, but it was just an honest tweet, and that guy's a dick. You see, the thing about it is, it's all very predictable. People label people. People put people in a box. What did I do today? I played guitar, ate some food, went and traded in some records. That's some man shit. I don't care what you say. Watching football all day. Well, I hope your little teamy won so your life can have purpose for a few days. I know I've got 3 new loop records and a few Cheap Trick records. I know that happened. There ain't nothing. There's nothing weak about that. And I built my cats a fucking fountain. That's right, fucker. I got down on my hands and knees and built my cats a fountain. Because I was told that these fountains inspire the cat to drink a bit more. That has not been the case yet. I got a pretty high-end one. I'm not saying it was thousands of dollars, obviously. It was under $100, obviously. But it was a porcelain cat fountain. The idea is the running water makes it very compelling to them. They like to stick their little cat noses into the running water to feel connected to something that is genetically wired in them. Perhaps they're by the bank of a river. Or a creek, or somewhere out in the wild that's inside of their genetic loop, in their little coil that's in their every cell that says running water, that means we're outdoors and we're hunting. I just hunted down that half a can of wet food and killed it. And now I'm going to stick my face in the running water of this creek that's in this nice bowl that's plugged into the wall. But so far, nothing has happened other than Monkey's been nervous about it. He's looked at it a couple of times. Doesn't make sense to him. Perhaps they know more than we think. Perhaps they're thinking in their deeply wild genetic history, their lineage, that goes all the way back to the first cat sitting by a river. Maybe he's thinking like, what does this asshole think he's doing? Does he think we think this is a river? What a fucking idiot. This is a nice bowl with a fountain in it. But I don't know if I'm going to drink out of it. And I know this isn't a big deal, but it is. You know, I guess that maybe football guys don't talk about this stuff. Football guys just drink freely and have no shame about sitting on the couch watching football with their fat hanging over their too tight pants with their team jerseys on. I'm not judging. I'm just saying their lines have been drawn between what a man is to some people, you know, the definitions of it. I without tools, built a cat fountain yesterday on Sunday. And again, I'm going to say I bought 3 Cheap Trick albums and 3 loop albums. And I did a little work. I plugged some things in, switched out some extension cords, did a little of that. Played some very serious guitar on a Gibson 335. Yeah, a Gibson 335. That's a fucking man's guitar. Built in Memphis, Tennessee, I laid out some licks on a Gibson 335, slightly distorted, powerful, while you sat and watched other men play with a ball. I was making real blues music with a man's instrument plugged into a tube amplifier. You want to have a cockfight? All right, what'd you do? Had some chips. Had a few brews, yelled at a television, was upset or elated because your team won. I sent distorted blues licks into the ether. My dick was so big in my living room that it annoyed my neighbors. Now watch my cat. I watch my cat look confused at a fountain. No, I was slightly upset by it because I want him to like it. So today on the show, a man named Bill Schecht is on. I don't know if I'd expect a lot of you to know who he is, but he is a comedian. And he's a writer for Letterman, and he's written several books, one of which is out now. His latest novel, Shrink Thyself, came out a little earlier this year. You can get that wherever you get books. He's had a couple other books, I believe, out there. Also, I wanted to mention that if you want to hear other episodes about what it's like to work on the David Letterman show, you can get the app. Upgrade to that premium. There's episode 28 with Eddie Brill, who does the warm-up for Letterman for years, did some of the comedy booking, no longer does that. Episode 228 with Meryl Marco, who was there at the beginning of Letterman and dated Letterman. And episode 270 with Chris Elliott, the amazingly funny Chris Elliott, who was on the first version of the Letterman show as a recurring guest and writer. Those are all available at the WTF app. You can get the free app and upgrade if you want to learn more about Letterman. But Schecht has been writing for the Letterman for like 15 years or more. I'm not sure. I'll talk to him about that. But outside of writing for Letterman, a couple of things. He was one of the first guys I ever really saw do comedy live. He had a disposition. He used to have a little cigar. He had an attitude, you know. And now, you know, I'll talk to him about that, and I'll talk to him about where he got that disposition. But what he also is known for is years ago, and you comic nerds, you comedy nerds, some of you, the certain type of comedy nerd know about this. Years ago, Bill Hicks, the last appearance he did on Letterman before he passed away was cut out. Bill Hicks did a Letterman set and it was cut from the final broadcast, and they aired a set that Bill Schecht did earlier that night on a different show even. Now, I never heard the true story. I know that David Letterman made an apology to Bill Hicks's mother publicly and I believe aired the set in its entirety, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't know what happened. We all assumed that he had said something to piss somebody off, whether it was about abortion or about, I can't remember. I had heard that it was censorship because of advertisers. But all I know is Bill Schecht was there. They used his set. So that kind of hung on him. He's the guy that replaced Hicks the night he got cut out of the Letterman show. Now, I'm going to ask Bill Schecht about it, and I'm going to get his angle on it. And you guys are going to do with it what you will, but he was there, and he's going to tell me what happened from where he was sitting. He was the guy that replaced Hicks. So if you're a deep comedy nerd, or you're a Bill Hicks fan, or you're a conspiracy theorist who's got an angle on that, now you'll have another angle, I guess, is what I'm saying. Is that okay? Good. I went to see Birdman. It's a very compelling flick. I think it's smarter than I even think it is. There were moments after the movie where I was like, I don't know, was that over the top or was that actually a smart movie? And then you sort of start thinking about it deeper. You're like, holy shit, some of those actors had to act in three different ways and three different levels. And it was interesting because some of it seemed a little broad and some of the characters seemed a little, heavy-handed. But then you're starting to think like, well, what was the real play? It all took place in a theater. So what's a play? What isn't a play? What kind of tricks are they playing with the cinema? And oddly, the only one that isn't, heavy-handed in a way is Michael Keaton, who plays this old actor who was known for this superhero he played in blockbuster movies. And it's a very sort of claustrophobically and creatively shot all within the confines of a theater, give or take a couple of exteriors at a bar and on the street. It dealt with theater versus celebrity versus in kids versus old people. And it dealt with a lot of stuff, but Edward Norton's always fucking solid and Michael Keaton was brilliant. And, Zach Galifianakis was in it. He was good. Everyone was good. It was an interesting movie. It was an interesting big movie. I don't know if I love the ending, but I'm not going to tell you what it is, but Keaton was great. And you guys know me. I am somewhat of a loner. I've had a lot of people on this show. I've had Michael Keaton on this show, and it was a great conversation. But do I talk to Michael Keaton? No. Do I talk to anybody really who's been on this show in a regular way? Not really, except for the ones that I'm closest to, close friends. But I took a chance, and I had an old email address for Michael Keaton. I just texted, "Hey, man, fucking great job in the movie. Hope you're well, Mark." I did that. I'm not expecting to hear back. I just thought, but you know, I always feel weird about that. Like, that, is he going to get that and go like, ugh, this is that kid from that podcast. Maybe I shouldn't have given him my email. I've never emailed him before except the one time when we were going to do the podcast. See, this is why. This is why I don't email. This is why I'm not giving John Hamm a call right now. This is why So let's talk to Bill Schecht here. This is a great conversation. It's one of my favorite as of late. I had a great time talking to this guy. Bill Schecht. It's weird because when, I got the opportunity to take a look at the book and they said Bill Schecht and he wanted to do the show. And there's a part of my brain. You have a solid place in my brain. Do you know why?
I think I do.
Really?
Well, I think I was one of the first people you saw do stand-up.
That's right. Is there any way that you were involved or emceed that event that HBO did, Catch a Rising Star, on campus?
No, Campus Comedy.
Campus Comedy.
At Tufts University.
That was where the show was.
Where they taped.
Right.
And I didn't emcee. Well, I did a lot of, before they got the show, they had all these talent shows at all these colleges.
Right, I auditioned.
And where did you audition? Did you audition in the basement somewhere?
Oh no, I auditioned first in a college classroom.
That's right.
Okay. And then we did a showcase at the Comedy Connection in Boston.
Okay,
but I believe you didn't MC the night. You know, you weren't on camera, I guess, but you didn't.
No, I did the warm-up for Joe Piscopo, and there were two tapings at Tufts. And there's two things that I remember about that night, is that my parents were there, and it was a huge...
Piscopo hosted.
And there were two tapings. So I was warming up, and right before I went on, I overheard my father say to a complete stranger, "If I got to go to another fucking stand-up show, that's it." And now I got to go on. And I did I did really well in the warm-up. And I did so well that the producers came up to me and said, Joe is going to do his own warm-up for the next tape.
Really?
Because I had no idea that he didn't have an act.
Right.
I had, you know,
he just had the characters or
right,
whatever.
So,
right.
So that's what I remember. But I probably, yeah, but I emceed a lot of those auditions. And I remember the one in the classroom. And
I didn't remember there being maybe that was it. You know, I didn't remember.
And
it wasn't a show.
And that's where I met Leary.
Really?
Because I met Leary at the auditions at Emerson, and he was like a graduate teacher.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I met him for the first time.
Yeah, because the thing I remember was that, you had this whole shtick in terms of like you were already an old man or something. You had a cigar.
That's about right.
You had a suit. Like, you know, you seemed to be very put together and you sort of cut an impression. Like, you made an impression on me.
So that's 83, so I was all of 26.
Yeah, I mean, you had this whole thing. You're very confident and you had your cigar and you were swaggering around.
Yeah. You got me the year I was confident. You got me that. You got me. And I would, yeah, because I'd been a sports writer and then I became a comic and I still went with the same kind of outfit with the tie down and the cigar. And whenever Jerry Seinfeld would see me at Catch a Rising Star, he would say, "Still trying to do that 5:45 to Greenwich thing, aren't you?"
But it was your thing, right?
That was my thing.
But where'd you come from? Why was your father at that show at Tufts? Did you come from New England?
I'm from Boston. I grew up in Boston. I grew up in
Newton?
Newton and Beverly.
Uh-huh.
And my father was a businessman, and my mother was a stay-at-home narcissist. And, that's what happened.
Yeah, my father was a doctor and narcissist, and my mother was a stay-at-home narcissist.
Yeah.
That's very funny. Now,
you auditioned for that show. Oh, that's wow.
Before I even did stand-up, I was in college, and I talked to my buddy on the 500th episode, my buddy Steve Brill. We put an act together because we saw the signs around the school. We went and put this act together. It was mostly sketches. It wasn't really stand-up. There was no real team dynamic. We didn't have any structure around like the way we interacted, but we did it.
Right.
And I had the stand-up bug early on, and I wanted to do stand-up, and I went down to catch, and I seen you. I saw you a couple other times, and you're always like, "That's that guy, the guy with the cigar from the thing,
the guy that's much older than he actually is." Yeah,
yeah, but you were just like, "Yeah, so
that
much.
Was the whole." Yeah, that was. I guess that was my shtick. I guess it was. It just was. I mean, that was my sort of outfit since birth. You know, the coat and tie and the tie down. And
no, I liked it. It was classic. It, you know, yeah. There are people that I guess they would call it branding now.
But you know who was on camp? Two things about campus comedy. One of the people that was on that show was Jeff Dunham.
Yeah.
Actually made it into...
When he only had one puppet,
that's right. Yeah. And it's the only show in the history of HBO that they never repeated.
Really?
I don't think they ever showed it more than once or twice.
What, it was that bad?
It was just, it was kind of nothing. It wasn't like the Young Comedian special.
It was a big idea, I think. They thought maybe they could franchise it. Like, you know, this is it, never ending. You know, we could just go audition kids all day long.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it at the end of the day, and I think that one of the, you know, and one of the people on the campus comedy show was a woman that was in my class at Harvard. So she was at least 27 or 28.
Wait. Let me try. Andrea Michaels
is right.
How hilarious is that?
Is that great?
How the fuck could I remember that?
I don't know. Wow. That's unbelievable. Let's go for 1,000 now. That is unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, I remember because she was attractive and she had this odd act and she did slightly provocative stuff.
Right. She was...
She had one joke that I'm trying to remember now, because I remember there was one joke she did I thought was really funny. It was kind of sexual.
I remember one joke that, of hers where she... that her breasts are different size, and so when she wears her University of Minnesota t-shirt, it looks like Minnesota.
Yeah, oh, right,
you know,
right.
That was right.
But, yeah, so you grew up in Newton...
Right.
And you went to Harvard?
Yes, I did.
Well, what was your life like? What did your dad do?
My dad was in the shoe business.
Shoes?
For a while. And then he was in the health and beauty aids business.
So he's not a salesman, but a what?
No, he was, you know.
A guy.
It was one of those things which, Dad, what are we supposed to put down where it says occupation? Just put executive. It was one of those guys. Yeah, yeah.
Too hard to explain.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, my mom, you know, a brilliant woman, was a great golfer and a stay-at-home narcissist, and they had six kids.
Six?
I was the fifth of six, a large Jewish family, never enough guilt to go around.
How was that?
I don't know. And my parents were more much more interested in having the children rather than raising them.
Them.
Yeah. So,
but six, that's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy.
If you're not Orthodox.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, it makes no sense. And, you know, liberal Jews, I used to do a line in my act that, you know, we believed in the Ten Commandments, but we believed you could pick five. And, you know,
that's all that funny.
Never, yeah.
But I notice it, like, on your wiki page, or even in, maybe it's on your... On your website, yeah. BillSchef.com, you don't list comic.
I was a comic for 13 years. Yeah, well, I do on in the bio. I say I was a comic for 13 years, and I'm very proud that I was a comic. I still feel like I'm a comic in many ways, and I was lucky enough to be a comic at the best time to be a comic, when the boom happened and you could really make a living. I mean, and you know my wife Adrienne Tulsh, I mean, we were out on the road 30 weeks a year, and
yeah.
This was right when...
How's she doing?
She's doing great, thank you. She was last year was a tough year, but she's great now. She's
oh good.
Yeah, she's great.
I remember her.
Yeah.
Well, that was... So are you the only show business kid in your family?
Yes.
What'd they all end up doing?
Well, my oldest brother is a professor. Journalism and literature down at North Carolina Central University. And my oldest sister is an occupational therapist. My other sister is a teacher. My other sister is a doctor. She's a clinical psychiatrist. And my younger brother went to Harvard after me, and he's the guy. If you're a police officer in Massachusetts, if you want to pass the sergeant's exam, you take his class. He lectures cops, and much funnier than I am. And he's got the he's got the shtick. I just had the words. My brother always had the shtick, but my funny family.
Yeah, it sounds like the real liberal Jews. Everyone went into reasonable, helpful occupations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not a businessman in the bunch.
No, because my mother was believed that you did service. And now I don't know how telling jokes at a Chinese restaurant is doing service.
So you're a sports fan, which I am not.
Yeah, I was a sports writer for a while, and that's where I started.
So your parents are supportive. You got into Harvard. Did your dad go to Harvard?
No, my dad went to Yale.
Right.
My mom went to Harvard.
So you had some pedigree there.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
And that helps.
I did the whole deal. I went to Deerfield Academy, which is an all-boys prep school.
Where's that one? In New Hampshire?
That's in Deerfield, Massachusetts.
Massachusetts?
Right by Springfield.
So it's not Exeter. It's not the other one, St. whatever. St. Paul?
St. Paul's. My brother went to St. Paul's. My older brother went to Andover.
Andover.
And my older brother was...
Isn't Exeter one?
Yeah. The big three are... Andover, Exeter, and Deerfield. Those mm-hmm. are the big three. And then you got the other places.
Right. Those are the ones that are sort of the preparing you for your place in the aristocracy.
Right. Now, when George Bush was not elected the first time in 2000.
The first one.
I said to my older brother, hey, how about your old stickball commissioner is now president of the United States? He said, what are you talking about? I said, George Bush, he was the stickball commissioner at Andover. When you were a freshman, he was a senior. He said, no, he said, you're wrong. He said, the stickball commissioner when I was a freshman was this asshole from Texas. Oh, yeah, right, same guy.
I don't know what's weirder about that story, that he didn't remember or that there's a stickball commissioner.
Yeah, well, that
the
was...
The fuck is a stickball commissioner?
Well, they had a stickball league at Andover for all the, you know, all the...
What the elite is doing in prep school?
Back then, in the 60s...
Taking a game that is notorious for coming from the streets out of lack of a field...
Right.
...and appropriating it for their,
now
for their waspy
got,
needs.
Right, it's this sort of irony, look at us slumming. Yeah. It's that whole...
Yeah, we don't have the equipment.
Right.
What, did they not play it on one of the two fields at the school? Did they play it in the parking lot?
We played it, and you would play it sort of... We played it, and we used sort of this transformer for the backstop. You would play it on some weird configuration or, you know.
Yeah, so you go to Harvard. You what, in English?
I majored in Latin because I thought the church was going to come back. And
come on.
You
were just trying to pass.
No, I swear I could, because I majored in classics. I thought that, you know, I was going to be, a Latin teacher or a pharmacist or whatever you're going to be.
With a Latin degree.
Yeah, and then...
did it help you at all? Did you read the classics?
Absolutely. I read everything, and it's the best training for a writer.
Why?
Because it teaches you the value of a word.
Uh-huh.
And you're reading, you know, I believe the greatest literature in the earliest form. I learned so much.
But Latin's like the root of most language.
Correct. And I majored in that, and I... there's only one thing you can do is be a teacher, and I came from a family of teachers. I think, well, maybe I'll do that.
Your mother was a teacher?
No. My mother did a lot of volunteer work in politics, and worked in the Jack Kennedy congressional campaign.
Oh yeah.
And I said, well, what was that like? He had the filthiest apartment I've ever seen. You know, really?
That's what we get. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a lot of my mom in this book, and also
in
it's
the new
her,
book.
She's 91, but I have taken the liberty of writing her eulogy
in the book.
In the book,
and Shrink Thyself.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff about her. She's a tremendous character. I once said to her, "Mom, how about a little unconditional love?" And she said to me, "I'll show you unconditional love when you've earned it," which is phenomenal. You really can't do any better than that. And another, I don't have that. The other one I have in the book was my younger brother came home one night and he said, "Listen, I've decided I'm going to run for office one day."
Yeah.
And my mother said, "Why are you going to do that? So you can win and run an employment agency?" And that was it. That was the end of it.
So she had gotten that cynical about politics at some point.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think so. But I mean, she was still interested and active, but she was very,
doesn't take long.
Yeah.
You know, once you work within it.
Right. So, yeah, I majored in Latin, but I also wrote for the paper at Harvard, the Harvard Crimson. I was a sports writer, and I always loved sports. My uncle was a very famous sports writer. My uncle was Herbert Warren Wind, the dean of American golf writers. He coined the phrase Amen Corner at the Masters. He wrote for The New Yorker for years, and he was a big influence on
me. Do you know him?
Oh, my God, yeah. We were, he's the most influential man in my life. And he's the reason I'm a writer as much as anything else. So I wanted to become a sports writer. And so out of college, I worked in Albany, New York for 2 years. And I don't know if you've been to Albany, but it's not some of God's best work. And
yeah.
A sports writer for 2 years. And then I quit the job and I came to New York ostensibly to become a freelance sports writer, but I couldn't make any money. And I had done stand-up. Between the ages of 18 and 22, I'd done stand-up like twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was one of those guys. When I was 18, we stole a faculty member's car at Deerfield, and I went out to a bar in Northampton. And I always thought it was kind of something I could do as a hobby. And then I realized that I couldn't make it, wasn't making any money. And I said, I guess I should sort of pursue this. And I auditioned to Catch a Rising Star in December of 1980. And I had, and the woman that was running auditions, she thought I was funny, but she thought I was a little arrogant. She wasn't wrong. And she wouldn't pass me. It took me 6 months to pass audition.
That's still a small amount of time,
but,
relatively
but
speaking.
But for me, being arrogant, it was very long.
Who
and
the
I,
fuck do you think you are?
Right.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, I got even with her because I married her. And that was
she
Adrian.
Was, oh, Adrian. Was
yeah, yeah, she was. She used to run audition night.
Oh, that's hilarious. So, before, and, before Lewis?
Right, before Lewis, before, I mean, yeah, it, back then, the MCs ran the show. They put people on.
Was Belzer gone already?
Belzer had just left.
All right, let's go back for 1 second. About sports writing, you know, and relative to stand-up in some way, in my mind, you know, when you tell me, not being a sports guy and certainly not being a golf guy, that your uncle was this well-respected golf writer.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, what does it take to make golf exciting? You know, what do you learn as a sports writer? I mean, I know obviously if you're into sports, you know, you live it, you breathe it. I learned that from a friend of mine. He, you know, it's how you feel alive. It's something that gets right. you out of yourself. And but what is some of the tenets?
Okay, well, that's easy to answer with golf, because golf is something that people are passionate about, whether they are good at it or not, because it's something you can play your whole life.
You play?
I don't play very much, and I look like a guy who doesn't play very much. I used to play a lot more, and you know, my mother was a wonderful golfer. My father was a good golfer. My brother's a good golfer. I just don't play enough. And
tell me the joy of golfing, Bill. Tell me why. I mean, you know, because I know people who love golf, like Ray Romano loves golf. There's people, you know,
John Mendoza loves golf.
Yeah, Kirk, my friend Kirk. It's just sort of like, what the hell is it? I know, you know, you're outside, you walk.
Yeah, you're outside. It's the, well, it's the pursuit of par. The fact that, you know, it plays to your most grandiose expectations about what you are as an athlete. And on a given day, you know, you and Tiger Woods mm-hmm. could be in a twosome together mm-hmm. at a par three. And Tiger could hit his drive way over the green, and you could hockey it up to about 20 feet short of the green and get down in two, and it might take Tiger three to get down, and in that moment you're better than him. So I think that that's the thing that people go that people,
so you can be better than the best on a good day
in a moment uh-huh. in a moment uh-huh. And Larry David loves, I mean I saw Larry David have the round of his life. He shot 38 on the backside at Riviera. And it was like a scene, you know, with Larry, you know how when people are out at dinner, and you know, straight people, yeah. you know, non-comics, they're out at dinner and something silly will happen and people will say, oh, this is just like an episode of Seinfeld. Yeah. And the difference is when you're with Larry,
yeah.
things happen. You know, you never know when like a little plot line in Curb Your Enthusiasm may break out.
Yeah.
And I was with Larry that day and he started, and all of a sudden this sort of gallery forms behind him. Of these gardeners and these caddies.
He's just on.
And you know, this is, hey, you know, Mr. David. Yeah. They're going crazy.
Because he was doing so well?
Yeah, because they were doing, and you know, maybe they thought.
He was just on a run. He was having,
yeah, and he never, I mean, he'll tell you he never played better than that afternoon. But people love it because, I think people love it because it's one of those things. It's such a simple game. And it's so aggravating, and you're just constantly pursuing being as good as you think you are. And then also, you can play it all year round. You can play it everywhere. Every courses are different. You can travel to play
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and, I get
and
it's
what
beautiful,
is, you
yeah.
know, because a tennis court is a tennis court is a tennis court.
Right, either it's
and
quiet
a basketball
or it's not.
Court
yeah.
is a basketball court, and a baseball, you know, but every golf course is different. So that's the thing that's fascinating.
Then you get to Scotland.
Yeah, right. And that's the right. And that's what's, I think that, and so
writing
people get
golf.
Involved in the equipment, mm-hmm. they get involved in the history, they get involved in golf course art. And my uncle was incredibly generous. Because he would share his knowledge. Every piece that he wrote, and he would write these 10,000 word essays for the New Yorker. And every piece that he wrote, and he's also, my uncle is a character in my first novel, The Ringer.
Yeah.
And every piece that he wrote was a history lesson, was an architecture lesson, it was a golf lesson, because he was not like a lot of writers who kept their real knowledge to themselves.
Well, so what it does then, and what makes him great, is it elevated it to an almost cultural criticism.
Correct.
So like anything, like a great essay or a cultural critic, you know, some of the sports writers, you know, have elevated it to that, to where it becomes about morality, mortality,
correct,
history.
Right. And my uncle, he covered every Masters from 1943 to 1988. And then he was sick in 1988. He had prostate. So he couldn't cover the 1989 Masters. So he gets out of the hospital and I say, you want to come over and watch it with me? And this is like, you know, this is like having Virgil read you the Aeneid. So he's sitting and he knows every blade of grass at Augusta. And it's one of those things where a guy hits and he says, oh, that's going to come up to a little oak on the left. And there it is. And there's two things that he hated about the Masters.
Yeah.
He hated the 17th hole and he hates Vern Lundquist. He hated the old CBS sports announcer who's still working, Vern Lundquist. So the first Saturday, we're watching, and they announce the guys. This is my favorite story about him. And we're watching TV, and they're announcing, okay, let's go down and see the course. You know, I'm Ben Wright at 15. I'm Gary McCord at 16. And I'm Vern Lundquist at 17. And my uncle says, that's a good spot for you, Vern! Screams at the TV. But I miss him. He's a tremendous guy. So, just crazy smart.
So writing about golf then, you know, it has this long history, you know, and it has a lot of, it's an old game. And
right.
So you can really sort of open it up to a lot of stuff. But writing about basketball, baseball, football,
right,
hockey.
There's,
as a sports writer, you got to write about everything, right?
Correct. Yeah, and he wrote about everything. He wrote great pieces about hockey and tennis. He's in the Tennis Hall of Fame. He's in the Golf Hall of Fame. He's a brilliant sports writer, but golf was his game.
So those are big shoes to fill that you decided to
follow. I was never going to be him.
But I know, but he's the one who inspired you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he was very encouraging, but nobody was happier when I got the job on the Letterman show than he was, because he always wanted for me to be able to write jokes for somebody else. He always loved that idea. He said, it would be great if you could, you know, if Bob Hope was still alive, and he was then. But he would say, Hope was still alive, it would be great if you could write for him. And Bob Hope is going to live for another 20 years.
You could have written for Bob.
Right.
But I think that's interesting because he saw it from an occupational point of view. He didn't necessarily think that being a comic was a smart journey, but to be a writer, you know, to be the guy that works.
But he understood that being a comic, that it had a lot to do with writing, that it had a lot to do with editing in your head, that it had a lot to do with wordplay.
But also to be successful, it had a lot to do with luck.
Right. Well,
they're always afraid for your security.
Right. But the thing is now, with some critical distance, I now figured out the thing that the comics that make it have, that of course,
oh,
that
Jesus,
I never
please,
had.
Please
Here's
tell
the
us.
Thing. Here it is. Adrian and I just figured this out.
Oh my God, this is years of study.
Okay, there's one thing a lot of them have. Balls.
Yeah.
Well, okay, that's balls. You gotta have balls. But you have to have complete and utter commitment in the material. It's the commitment. You know, that's the thing about Hicks. When they talk about Hicks, you know, his stuff was great. But the commitment to the material.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You know, Martin Short, you know, he comes on, and there's no better Letterman guest than Martin Short. And
great panel guest.
Yeah, and he does those silly songs, mm-hmm, and they're just nonsense. But the commitment, he acts like this is the greatest song ever written, and I'm the greatest singer ever.
But he's, you know, he's a song and dance man.
Right, but it is, but they are for, you know, they are comedy songs.
Right.
But it's the, but he commits.
Right, well, that's hilarious, yeah, right. But also, like, in stand-up, it has to be commitment behind a point of view.
Absolutely.
Because if you're just a joke teller, you're going to struggle a little bit, no matter how committed you
are
to your
joke. Right,
to
me, that was, now we're talking 25 years later, my problem was always, hey, you know, I wrote it, I think it's well-written, here it is.
Right.
Not good enough. That's not a performance.
Right, but it becomes, who is this guy? Getty's got a Jack and a cigar.
Right, right.
But you know what? You know what's his angle? Because if you really think about even that generation, you know, 1980. Well, Richard Lewis is already gone, but you know, like Larry and Jerry and Bill Maher, even as a monologist, there was some point of view.
Absolutely. 1,000%.
You know, even Henny Youngman.
Well, you know, I remember, you know, Maher once said about Jerry that he's thrown away an A act. Jerry used to do, and he only did this bit a couple of times. He used to do a bit about getting bar mitzvahed, and you're 13, and it's today I am a man. He said, you know, when I was 13, I had terrible skin, my voice was cracking, none of my clothes fit, I was awkward, I was gangly. If somebody's car broke down and they saw me standing on the side of the road at 13, they wouldn't say, hey, you think we can get that man to help us? And it was such a, and it always got a laugh, but Jerry tossed it out because I think he didn't want to be associated with being
a Jew.
To me, you know, standing on the sidelines, like, why, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that he marks, I mean, and as an observer, maybe you could validate this, that he marks the transition out of Jewishness in a way.
Absolutely, 1,000%.
And 1,000%. Because like the 70s, it was all neurotic Jews.
Right.
Give or take a few, Latinos, right. Other ethnicities, you know. Right. But the New York sort of cultural tone defined comedy for the country in a way.
Right.
And it was all Jewish. And for years before that. And I think Jerry, with the name, you know, that he just gutted the Jew out of it.
Right.
It's interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember, you know, when I was starting and every once in a while I would get a note back from agents or people in the business, you know, you lean on that word Jew a little too much. And, you know, it's like, well, I think it's funny and I wouldn't really listen to it. And then like 5 years after me, John Stewart comes along and it's Jew.
Brought it
and
back.
He's a genius, you know. But again, the difference between me and he had, I think, great commitment to the way he was delivering the stuff. Much
more
commitment.
He did. Him as a stand-up, when, you know, before he became, he had a couple of jokes that were very smart. And he was politically bold always, but not over heavy-handed.
Right.
And I like him as much as I, you know, I'm jealous of him.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, all right, so you get there in 1980. You become a house MC, one of three.
Right.
You're part of a long legacy of well, you know, Belzer sort of defined that job.
Absolutely.
And he was out of control in a lot of ways.
He was out of control. And the thing is that and Bill Maher did this, and I never did this. Bill Maher would do a lot of time between acts. If there was somebody,
he was the MC the comics waiting hated.
Right, and he and he was if someone was in to see someone else, you know, Bill did a good nice bit of time so they could see, and you know that's smart
to see
and,
him
and I never had that in me. This is why I ended up in Albany after I got out of Harvard and not at the Times or the Washington Post, because I was the one guy at Harvard that didn't think to call the Times or the Washington Post and think, are there any Harvard guys there?
Yeah.
I just said, well, I'll send out my clips and the best.
You had some, you were humble or insecure, one or the other.
Let's go with insecure.
All right.
I ain't humble.
Because Harvard now is a tremendous cachet. The brotherhood.
Yeah.
Of the Lampoon Brotherhood.
But
of the Harvard Brotherhood.
But I was the one guy, well, because of a decision I made at 18 to write for the Crimson rather than Lampoon, it took me much longer to break into television. Because I had no connections.
But Harvard was all about connections. It was about protecting connections.
That's correct. That's correct.
And you chose not to do that because you're like, I don't know, maybe I'm, you know, just send my stuff out.
Yeah, right, right. This is a meritocracy. You know?
I'm going to let my stuff stand on its own.
And years later, when my first book came out, The Ringer, I was talking to a woman that was an editor at Newsweek who was a year ahead of me at Harvard, and I explained to her what I had done as a senior and just sending my clips out, and let's see what happens. And she looked at me and said, isn't that cute? You know,
right.
Yeah.
You didn't understand what Harvard was
I
for.
I had no idea.
All right, so you're house MC, and I remember seeing you there occasionally. I never, you know, to be quite honest with you, I never passed at the original catch, and I could not stand Louis Veranda. And I to this day I still have resentment, the unresolved resentment.
So you're into the, we're talking the 90s now.
Well, no,
I left in 80, Adrian and I left New Year's Eve in 87.
Right. So I get there. No, I get there in 89, and I'm already working. You know, I'm up in Boston, and you know, I auditioned at all the clubs, and I got to sit. You know, hey, sit. Maybe I'll get you on. I was that guy.
Right.
Hang out at the bar. You know, maybe I'll get you on. And I just could not deal with it. But I got in at the Improv right before it ended, and
that's where we met. We met at the Improv.
So you're knocking it out, you know, for 13 years as a comic. Was there a moment where I know that life, and I know I always lived that life. I never thought to be a writer. I never, you know, never even crossed my mind. And, you know, I spent a lot longer than that, you know, beating my head against the wall. Was there a moment where you're like, I got to shift?
Well, it was for the 13 years, the first six, I loved it. And like the second seven, unbeknownst to me, I was kind of trapped because it was how I made a living. I didn't know how to do anything else.
Right.
It's
a horrible moment.
No other skills.
But you can write sports.
I had a couple of shots at that, but those are other stories. And the Letterman show came on in 82, and I submitted as a writer for them. I tried to get on as a comic. I came close to the Tonight Show. You know, I have the heartbreak stories like all of us do about the Tonight Show and Letterman Show. And I submitted the Letterman Show in 84, 85, 86, 87,
package. 88. Monologue, jokes, sketch ideas.
And the whole thing. And, you know, in show business, when they want you, they'll get in touch
with
you.
Who told you how to do that? I mean, how did you know? Was there a comic?
I knew Bob Morton, who used to come in and see the comics, who was the producer.
Yeah.
And Steven Starr, who was my agent at William Morris, and they would say they're looking for somebody, and never even came close. So I took 1989 and 1990 off.
Yeah.
From submitting.
To be sad?
Just that, well, I guess, you know how you feel,
yeah.
How,
hard.
Well, I guess the business has made its decision about me. You know that. Yeah. And I was on the road, and I could sense the shift on the road.
Yeah.
That clubs were closing.
Yeah.
And then in 91, I got a couple of small jobs. I got a job on Dennis Leary's show on the Ha Network.
Yeah, before Comedy Central, right.
But it was a show called After Drive with Billy Kimball. And Billy Kimball hosted.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got another small job. And then Adrian and I were having breakfast at the Friars, and Morton was there. And I walked up to him and I said, "Are you looking for Rice?" He says, "We're not looking for anybody." He says, you know, just write some jokes. He says, "Dave's always looking for jokes." So, I didn't have any work that week, so I started writing jokes. And he only used to do three at NBC. And on the Thursday night show.
On the original show?
Two.
Really? I didn't realize
Because
that.
There was only, because there was one rule at late night. Do not be the Tonight Show.
Right.
So the monologue was opening remarks, and it was kind of tossed off. So that Thursday night, he does one of my jokes. And then Friday night, he does one of my jokes. And then Morton calls me back. And if you were a comic back then, Morton never called anybody back. He called me back. He says, "Turns out we're looking for a monologue writer." And I got hired the next week. And that was in 91. I've been there ever since.
You're still there?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So I guess my question specifically is, you know, as the MC at Catch at that time, I mean, I can imagine what, you know, Bill Maher was doing and Jerry, and I can imagine that. But, you know, these mythical stories about Larry David as a comic, I've only got some, you know, you hear half things, but you saw it.
I saw it, and here's the deal. So I pass at Catch in June of 81. So now, and I'm working late night, I'm going on at 2 in the morning, then I become a late night MC. So now it comes around, and it's December of 1981. It's the holidays, so all the comics, the New York comics that live out in L.A., they come back. So the shows, which are normally great, now you've got these guys that have come back for the holidays. So Larry is and, you know, Larry David's here, and he was on Fridays then. So I'm in the hanging out in the bar, me and Ron Zimmerman.
Ron Zimmerman, how's he doing?
He's great. He's a producer and he shares best friend. What else could be wrong?
Do you talk to him?
Every once in a while.
Yeah. Okay.
So we're in the bar, mm-hmm. and Larry is pacing back and forth up and down the bar, and Zimmerman says, "Hey, what's with the pacing?" And Larry David said, "Do you know that Woody Allen used to throw up before he went on every time?" And I think, I got to go in and see this.
Yeah.
So
hadn't he done it in a while?
So
what?
he was always. So now I go inside and Larry goes on. Yeah. And this is the holidays. It's 10 at night. It's 1981. It's packed. Ketch is the center of the comedy universe.
Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen from Friday's Larry David, and they go crazy. And he gets on stage, and the first two lines kill. The first line is, you know what they say about attractive people? We're not well-liked. And, you know, is it okay if I use the familiar two-form with you people? Because instead is much two-form, you know.
Yeah.
So the two lines kill. Then he does a line that doesn't work that well.
Yeah.
And he says, is it hot in here? Then he does two lines that kill, and he has another line that doesn't do that well. Listen, it's very, very hot in here. Then he does one line that kills and one line that doesn't do well. You know, you pay these kind of prices and the air conditioner is faulty. Then he does two lines in a row that don't do well. It's really very, very hot in here. And at that moment, some guy in the audience has the nerve to say, hey, what's your problem? My problem? I'll tell you what my problem is you people don't in the air conditioner and screaming and storms off. And that's the first time I ever saw him. And that incident was repeated thousands of times.
One way or another.
Yeah. And it would always be, and we got to be friends, and it was one of those things where I would be on the phone with him and I would say, so how's it going for you? Have you been getting in any confrontations with people? Absolutely not my... wait a minute, the dry cleaner today, and he would tell some crazy story. And still, you know, with Larry, and you know, it's funny about this book, which is the Shrink Thyself, which is about a guy that leaves therapy. You know, Larry David was one of those guys, is one of those guys that thinks that therapy is nonsense. He thinks it's absolute nonsense, and he thinks, you know, they're just so bored. All they ever want to hear is, I want to have sex with my aunt. Mm-hmm. He says, if you don't have that, you might as well not go to therapy.
Do you believe that?
No.
Yeah.
I don't believe that. I do believe that there are many, many therapists out there, like there are many stockbrokers, and there are probably seven good stockbrokers.
Right.
And there are probably, you know, seven really good, you know, it's just out there. And as my father used to say about stockbrokers, you know, if they knew anything, they wouldn't be brokers.
Yeah.
You know, and, but Larry... And the thing about Larry, and I want to give him a lot of credit about this, he's the only guy that I can think of that has gotten more regular as he's gotten more famous. It never happens
that
way.
He's a very pleasant guy off stage.
It never happens that way because you never hear them interviewing a neighbor and saying, you know, I grew up with him, and he was a real asshole, but then he became famous. Now he's a pussycat. You know,
I think you exercise a certain amount of your demons once you become relevant and validated.
Absolutely. But Larry is much more accessible now in his fame as he ever was. Now, that said, you know, anytime you're with him, you never know when a scene from Curb is going to break out. And the story that I tell is a few years ago, he's in town, and we're having dinner. And it's time for dessert. And I say, how about dessert? No, no dessert for me. Ted Denson and I have a bet. No dessert for a year. And I'm thinking,
what's going on?
Larry David. It's Ted Danson. Yeah. They're both billionaires.
Yeah.
What the bet's got to be like 50,000 or 100,000. Maybe the bet's like $1 million.
Yeah.
And I say, how much is the bet for? $200. I said, have a piece of fucking cake. But it's still, you know, he still is that guy.
Yeah. Well, that's life. Right. It's the little things.
And that's
right?
The way he has to be.
All right. So you get the gig at Letterman.
Right.
And you're there almost 25 years.
Right.
And you have not written your first book yet.
No, I don't write my first book I write my first book, which is everybody's first novel, which is 110,000 words, 80,000 of which are I. That doesn't get published. I write my second book, The Ringer. That gets published in 2002.
Okay.
My second book, Time Won't Let Me, about a band, 2005. My third book, Everything Hurts, 2009. And this book, Shrink Thyself.
And you have an audience for your books.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as big as I would like.
You feel like you're getting better?
Absolutely. 1,000%. And I think this is my best. This is in the first person. And I think that this is the most accessible, to use that word again, of all my novels. Because, you know, the first one was about a guy that makes a living as a softball ringer in New York. And, you know, that's kind of tough. That's a kind of a small audience. And there's some prescription drug abuse in there. And you would think that would have drawn some. The second book is
about...
But
that's
about,
a comedic setup. It's
right,
a satire.
Right. Yeah, they're all satirical in their own way. I mean, they're deathly serious to me. Yeah. When other people call them satires, I say, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. The second book is about, was inspired by a story that happened to my older brother about his band in prep school. They cut an album, and then 15 years later, the album was worth $5,000 for collectors. So yeah. I recreated that story, but... You know, that his story is a little too cute and neat. In my story, it's 30 years later, the album's worth $10,000, and the guys can't get out of their own way to reunite.
Yeah.
But that was a very specific 60s garage, you know, garage rock.
Yeah.
That was a very specific. The third book, Everything Hurts, was about a guy trying to get rid of a psychosomatic limp. You know, again, you know, these are sort of high-minded things, you know, but this one... You know, everybody has either been to therapy, knows somebody that's in therapy, has had a bad experience, has had a good experience. And this is about a guy that tries to leave therapy and tries to live the unexamined life.
Uh-huh.
And the second he makes that decision, things happen to him that would send anybody else screaming back into therapy.
Uh-huh.
So in that sense, I think that I'm reaching people a little better.
Now, and there's a lot of you in there.
Less than the other books. The other books I usually run about 60 true, 40%. You know, the best advice I ever got about fiction was make your characters' lives complicated. You know, write what you know, make your characters' lives complicated. So you take what's true and you say, well, what can I do to make this complicated? This book,
interesting.
There's a lot of elements from my life, but what happens in this book, I never had sessions with my shrink in a mental hospital while the shrink was in the mental hospital.
Oh, okay.
I never did that. I never told my shrink about a fantasy affair that I tried to carry out, and then the shrink went and looked up the same woman and had an affair with her.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah. So these things, you make it a little...
Sounds a little dark.
Yeah, it's absolutely dark. It's absolutely, because it's not interesting the other way. It's not, you know, there's a lot of people that you can read. And, you know, I try to be funny and I try to be humble.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who are your guys in terms of writers?
Well, Philip Roth.
The best,
and Richard Yates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Richard Yates.
I don't know his stuff.
Oh,
I know Philip.
Oh, you need to read Richard Yates because
what are his books?
Revolutionary Road, which was made into not a good movie. That's his most famous novel. Easter Parade.
I'll check it out.
A Good School. But he is, and you know, here's another connection. The character of Elaine in Seinfeld was not based on Carol Leifer as she is. Don't tell her that. It was based on Monica Yates, Richard Yates' daughter, who Larry went out with.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's who it was based on.
Wow.
And breaking news.
So,
and Richard Yates is the king of 1950s and 60s broken suburbanite alcoholics. You know,
he picked up the Cheever torch or what?
But better than Cheever,
Updike?
Better than Updike, I feel, because as I say, Richard Yates, his books are meant to be read by the light of your oven.
Yeah.
I mean, they're so depressing and I don't know. When I read the depressing stuff, it really lifts. It's so much richer.
Sure.
Than
it gives Jews a warm feeling.
Absolutely. And he's not. And he's guyish.
Yeah.
You know, Yates is guyish and we're full guy. And but Philip Roth is my hero.
It's amazing that you find the time to do this. And this was obviously at some point your dream unrealized, and then you realized it to be a novelist.
It well put. I always thought that I didn't have the gene in me to write a long form because I was writing jokes, I was writing scripts, I was a stand-up, I was a sports writer. To me, it was all in installments. And
there's that insecurity, that unlike Harvard insecurity that you carry with you.
Right, and what happened was, I just didn't think I had it. I wanted it badly, but I never had it. And then when I was, I picked up a book when I was 38 that called The Artist Way, which is a tremendous book.
Yeah, I remember that book. They had workshops.
And that...
That did it?
Changed my... I mean, I'm the millionth person whose life it changed because it, you know, you do these morning pages, which I still do 18 and a half years later, and it just kind of blows off. It's like blowing off the foam on the top of a beer. You just get all that crap out in the morning, and your mind is a little more open.
Did it help you joke writing?
Absolutely. 1,000%
Really?
1,000%
Well, you just sit down for a period of time?
You do 3 pages. It takes 20 minutes. I've been doing it for years, and it's very journalistic. It's like, you know, the dry cleaning didn't come back.
Right.
You know, it's like that. But you just get that stuff, and you get to see the other thing. It's very valuable because you get to see your hand move.
Mm-hmm.
You get to be a writer first thing when you wake up.
You did it by hand?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what you have to do? You can't do it on the computer?
You know, people do, but I don't think it's the same thing.
Huh.
People do. People do.
I did that. I journaled during my divorce every day because I had no choice, it seemed.
Right. And how did did that help you? Did that help you?
It helped me, but reading it now is very painful.
Well, I read. Yeah. I mean, I read my stuff after the fact. So I'll just here's the deal. So yeah. I start doing the morning pages in August of 1995.
Right.
And I'm doing them every day. In October of 1995, I stopped gambling. I was a degenerate gambler.
Really?
In November of 1995, I stopped drinking. And in December of 1995, I start working on my first novel. And
correlation to
them. Absolutely, 1,000%.
A degenerate gambler.
Degenerate gambler. I say that, and you can, and I'm sorry we're on the radio, but you can see me kind of smile when I say that because it's, yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, absolutely.
That was your thing?
It was my thing. Well, everything was my thing, but that was my daily thing.
Did you ever, what was the edge you reached? How much did you lose?
Oh, I came, well, I remember, well, you know, you used to have to settle up every week.
Uh-huh.
With my bookie. And I remember I owed my bookie, $39.95. I owed him, you know, $3,909. And I said to him, I said, hey, you just make sure you bring the five. Right.
But you never got to a point where you had to borrow money or?
I came as close as you can come. I came, well, I mean, I was under.
Yeah.
So, and I was one of those guys. I mean, when I was $50,000 in debt before I got the Letterman job, this was my fantasy. We were $50,000 in debt, not just the gambling, but other stuff,
yeah.
You know, being comics,
yeah.
You know.
Sure.
Right. And this was my plan. My plan, $50,000 in debt, was to get hit by a cab
and
sue the cab company for $60,000.
That was your plan?
Not for a million. You're supposed to sue for a million,
sure.
And settle for,
right.
60. No, it was 60, and I figure, you know, give the lawyer a taste, and then I would be straight.
Well, you're a reasonable man.
Yeah,
you're a moral guy.
That's right.
Were you standing out in the street trying to figure out how to do it, or didn't get?
It wasn't
that?
Until years. It wasn't until about a year after I stopped gambling that I actually got hit by a cab.
Timing.
It was entirely my fault, and it was one of those things where I stepped off the curb, and I felt it. And as I'm in the air, I'm thinking, this is what it must be like to get hit by a cab. And then I landed on the hood, and I was okay. And the guy was shaken up. The cab driver was beside, and I said, I'm okay, and it was my fault. And of course, he'd never had anybody say that to him.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and I was okay, amazingly.
This insecurity streak makes you a moral man.
Well, good. Well, who am I to disagree with you?
Yeah. But, all right, so, well, congratulations on the new book, but I do want to get into your relationship with Letterman, and because he's so, you know, he's a hero of mine.
Okay.
And, you know, were you there when I did the panel last time?
Absolutely.
It's the first time I ever did panel.
I know. And
it was great.
I was there. Well, it must have been very significant for you because you don't remember me coming up and saying good job.
No, I do. I do.
But of course, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like, because I'd done the show a few times. I never really thought he registered me. And but to sit there with him was a big deal, you know, to look at him and have that opportunity.
I get it, and he doesn't. You can tell him, as I have told him many, many times, You have no idea what it means to comics to come and sit with you. You have no idea what it means to them. He said, oh, that's nonsense. It, you know, and I said, what do I have to do to convince you?
It was mind blowing to me. It was a high point. You know, doing the show.
Already, you know, I was in, I don't want to brag about my acting career, but I was in Beer League. I played the umpire. And Artie Lang came on the show after Beer League. And he was great. And he told the stories. And he said to me, biggest thrill of my career.
Yeah. Yeah, to just sit there across from him, because you're fighting with this thing of like, it's Dave Letterman's right there.
Right.
He's right there, you know.
And having been a guest on the show to promote my books and working with him every day, and then all of a sudden sitting in the chair, I get it. Because it's different for me, because the thing, and I don't know if you know, I don't know if this hit you, but the thing when I'm sitting in the chair and I'm a guest on the show and I look at him, he is so comfortable. And I am so not comfortable. And I thought, I'm not even going to compete as in conversation with this, because this is completely his turf.
And it's so heightened too, because, like, you know, you are just talking, but there, it's almost an out of body experience in the moment,
right?
Because you want to just talk, but then you realize, like, it's like, this is his world. This is Dave's universe here, and you're on television. It's just so. Like, his comfort in the face of all that is astounding.
Right, and it's become much more so in the last 10 years. Because
I think since the heart surgery.
1,000%, because now he doesn't care if the show runs over and has to be edited down. I mean, he cares, but he cares more about finishing the conversation that he started. He cares more about the connection.
Oh, good. And that's new.
Well, absolutely. Decade. I mean, it was always there, but I think that...
I think he got warmer.
1,000, yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And I think that he realized the job wasn't going away, and this is what he loved to do. And, you know, if you just have a regular conversation with him, he asks the questions, it's just in a regular conversation, that nobody else asks. And there's a lot of times just during the day where, we'll be talking about something that I feel pretty knowledgeable about. And he'll ask me a question and I'll go, excuse me for a second. And then I got to go to the computer to get an answer for him. At 1 second, you know. Yeah.
Now, I find it to be mysterious in that, you know, you hear things here and there that, you know, he's insulated. He doesn't like to talk to people. He's not accessible. He's a little kooky. And but do you consider him a friend? You guys
Absolutely.
Socialize?
No, we don't. Maybe a couple times a year, you know, I'll go with him somewhere where he wants to go. But we don't. We used to play squash for a while. But we don't. I think that we get it's so intense. You know, I work for him and we have the friendship at the show.
No, I get that.
One of those things. But I'll tell you, and this is
you got to be the guy that's been there the longest, or one other guy.
No, well, Steve Young has been there, started a year before I did, so he's the writer that's been there the longest. And we have a lot of people. I mean, Barbara Gaines and Jude Brennan have been there since the morning show. You know, we did a thing when he was 30 years in late night, which was 2012. We did a top 10, and it was the top 10 longest serving staffers. I didn't come close to making that list.
And who's the one guy that had been there forever, the comedy writer?
Well, Jerry Mulligan. No, he retired in 2004.
Right.
But he had been there a long time. And he had also been on the morning show. But I was thinking, pursuant to my book, about, well, how am I going to tie in Dave with my book? So I was seeing a shrink years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those things, you know, when you see a shrink, you're not supposed to know anything about them, and they're not supposed to talk about themselves. So at the time, it was about 1995 or 1996, and CBS had been sold to Westinghouse. And the guy that was in charge of Westinghouse was a guy named Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah.
And Dave was upset that the guy had not called him. So for a week or maybe two, every night, behind the desk, he would say, listen, I've decided that I'm going to fight this guy. And he would say, so one time I come into my shrink appointment, and sometimes we would talk about the show, but most times we had to talk about the stuff that you got to talk about in therapy that's way much earlier than Letterman.
Yeah.
And I sit down, and my shrink says, listen, Bill, before we begin, I just, now, you know, I don't watch the show, but the other night I was up late, and I happened to have the show. Well, was Dave challenging his boss to a fight? And then that's that situation, if you've ever been in it, where all of a sudden you're the therapist.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you have to say to your therapist, okay, go with that. Well, what do you mean fight? And, yeah. Well, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, and that's the effect that that's the effect that this guy has on everybody. And at first, after when he announced his retirement, and, you know, every day people were coming up to me and saying, what are you going to do? And their worry did not seem very real. And I was like, look, we got 200 shows left. I'll worry about that after the 200 shows. I'm not even thinking about that. But then it took another person to point out to me, look, this isn't just happening to Dave. And this isn't just happening to all of us that work there. This is happening to everybody that's watched him for 33 years. So when people say to me, what are you going to do? They're just saying, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so now I'll have any conversation with people uh-huh. about that.
Yeah. In my mind, it's like he waited till Jay left first.
I think that absolutely had a, I mean, it was, you know, it's the TKO. It's the guy that can't answer the bell.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll tell you what I said to him, one day, this is a few months ago, this is before the announcement, and this is after, so let's say it's April. Mm-hmm. So Jay had left in February, and it's during a break, and I look at him and I said, is it me, or does the air just smell sweeter with Jay not on it? And you just the little corner of his mouth came up. Yeah.
Just. I'll tell you, man, you know, he's done some amazing stuff, you know, and I watched him at the beginning when I was in college, and I the way he handled that blackmail attempt was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life.
I mean.
Just to come clean and just gut that guy. I thought it was great.
Well, you know, I think that I remember it was sort of an odd day, and you know, you wondered how he would handle it, and he handled it. You know, he got out in front of it, and then of course we did two shows that day, so we did it in the first show. In the second show, Larry David is the lead guest,
uh-huh.
and he had been there early and heard the first. Is what if I walked into? You know. It's like,
yeah. Why this day?
Yeah,
that's hilarious. He's always treated you well, and he treats the staff well, and he's a good
absolutely.
Man.
And but think about, well, I mean, you know, a lot of people that are famous that have had jobs a long time. It's you think about that job.
It's insane.
It's an insane job. And think about, I'll just choose this name. Think about having to interview Jasmine Guy twice a year for 30 years. And I'm thinking, I use Jasmine Guy because she probably used the publicity just as an example of somebody that the people that you have to talk to. And he makes it seem like he is interested. And if if he's not interested, he turns it so that it's compelling to watch.
Right. Yeah.
And gets the person. So.
Sometimes it's great when he's like a little irritated. He used to be more so. But yeah.
Well, I've often said about him that he's the only guy, and I challenge anybody, another name. He's the only guy in the history of television whose mood has been chronicled on television.
Yeah.
Now, Roseanne. Nobody crazier than Roseanne. You know, she's been a guest of the state a few times. But you never watch an old episode of Roseanne and think, oh, yeah, yeah, this is when she was having a fight with the network.
Yeah.
No, because she's doing her show and she's locked in. That's the thing about Dave is that as a, you know, maybe as a guy, not accessible, but as a human being.
public, you know, yeah,
right.
The public persona.
Very accessible.
No,
it's
yeah.
like, oh,
he lives there.
He's upset. Yeah, that's right. He lives there. And that's what's, it's amazing to watch. And the longer I'm there, the more I understand how difficult the job is.
Oh,
his job is
brutal.
Because, you know, I consider myself a comic. You know, you're a comic and you think, well, I could go out and tell a monologue. I got some stuff.
Yeah.
And then I could talk to people.
Sure.
Yeah. You could do it for a night or two nights or a week.
But every
But what about
night.
33? I mean, what about that?
Yeah.
And he's always been, the first one in, the last one out. People ask me, a guy asked me about, does he still like to do it? Well, all I can tell you is I get down to the dressing room at 2:45, and then he comes up and we go through the monologue. And there's two flights of stairs.
You're the head monologue guy.
Right. Me and Steve Young. And so I'm waiting for him, and he's 67, and he runs up those two flights of stairs every day.
He used to run them all, didn't he? Because I remember the first time I did it, I actually saw him in like mid-run. It was weird.
No, he runs the whole hallway, and then he runs the two flights of stairs at the end. So forget that he's 67 and can do that. Forget that. But that's, he's running up those stairs because he wants to start his day. And when I see him stop running up those stairs, then I'll say, all right, well, maybe you don't want to do this, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's go over this one other thing. Which is, if I'm not mistaken, the night that they pulled Hicks's set, did it.
Right.
You did the set.
Right. I am that footnote, and absolutely. And
just to set it up for people that don't know, Bill Hicks had done a set, and it was fairly controversial, and, he was censored. And there's been a lot of, I think the true story is probably out there, but they pulled the set. He reacted to it in Lars' column in New York Magazine, the guy that they played your set.
Right. So let's just back up.
For
so Adrian,
yeah.
My wife Adrian Tulsh is working in Houston where she used to work all the time, and she sees Hicks, and she says to him, "Listen, if you come to New York, I will get you seen by the Letterman people and you'll get on." And she had only said that to one other person, who was Emo Phillips. And it happened for him. So Hicks says, okay. So she calls Morton, and Morton again returns her call, which never happened, and says, "You remember with Emo, I got another guy." And so Morton comes in. Now, Jay, of course, has spent the last 20 years telling everybody it was his idea. You know, like everything in show business is Jay's idea. But my wife got Hicks the Letterman show, and he did it, I think, 8 or 9 times at NBC. And he was one of there were about 5 comics that worked the show a lot, him and Jake.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can't remember the other guys, but Wayne Cotter used to do the show, and Margaret Smith,
yep.
Peg Smith. And now we go to CBS, and it's our 25th show. It's our 5th week. Stephen Wright was the first comic to be on the new show.
Oh, okay.
To be on the new show. And Hicks is booked. And Hicks and I are old friends. I opened for him. I did, when he taped his first album, I opened for him. And, I knew him for a while. I was very fond of him.
Yeah.
And I was doing the audience
for him. He's a good guy. He was in New York for a couple of years. Remember that? He's like, I got to get out of here.
And we were down at Caroline's, and he was great, and he would work the improv. And again, the commitment to the material. So before the show went on the air, they did 2 shakedown shows where they test the equipment and audience and all thing. And I was on the second shakedown show doing stand-up. And I was still
test a show.
Yeah, I was still a stand-up then.
Yeah.
It was probably one of the last sets I ever did, and went great, and that was it. So now here's Hicks, and I go backstage before the show, and he's got, and I'll never forget this, he's wearing a yellow button-down shirt and a yellow tweed, like a herringbone jacket, completely. Yeah. And I said, what is this? He said, this is the new friendlier Bill Hicks. And I said, oh, okay, right. So now he comes out, and the set is
89.
No, this is 93. This is October 1st, 1993.
So he's sick already,
right? And nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, nobody knows. He dies in December. So he comes on, And he gets some laughs, some big laughs up front. But the set is, it's not like a Hicks set. It's just odd. And some of the choices are odd. And it's not the balls out.
But it
out.
Was produced, right? I mean, you
right.
knew.
It was, well, it was, yeah, the stuff that was selected probably should not have been selected. That's the problem, is that the set was not built to his advantage.
Who was the segment producer?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't remember who it was back then. And, but, you know, he does well, but there are a couple of odd moments. And knowing him as I do, not of him, but I don't think anything of it. And then he goes, and Dave was laughing at a couple of things up front. And he sits down with Dave, does a little panel with Dave. And then Dave says, hey, good luck with your mail. That's the last thing Dave says to him.
Because of the
abortion
joke, right.
And because of the gay, it was, I think there's a couple of things. So that's it. And I go over to him backstage, and he said, well, how do you think that went? And I say, it went great. Dave was laughing, and he was at Caroline's that weekend. And I said, I'm going to come see you at Caroline's, because we were friends and I love Colleen and the yeah. whole deal. And then he was going down to West Palm.
Yeah.
So now I come upstairs, and Jeff Stilson was a writer on the show. And you know Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff, very strong comic.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff is waiting for me. And he says, what was that? And they're old friends, him and Hicks. He says, what was that? I said, oh, geez, so it's not just me. Because I thought it was odd. And there was... the very first line of it was very hacky for mm-hmm. him, that let's hunt and kill Billy Ray Cyrus.
Right.
Very hacky, not like him
yeah.
to do something like that. And so I figured, oh, great, I'm not the only one that thought it was a little beneath mm-hmm. him. And then I'm up in my office and I do whatever I do. And then I come down and it's Dave and Bob Morton and some CBS people. And I say goodbye because it's Friday night. And Dave says, hey, watch the show tonight and you'll be in for a surprise. And I say, oh, shit, was I caught on camera? Which used to happen as a warm-up guy, and you didn't want to be caught on camera.
Yeah.
And he says, yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I didn't know was that they were discussing that they were going to cut my Shakedown show performance in. And they did not make that decision till really late. As a matter of fact, what people don't know is that the open announce, the show was rolled in live at 11:30, and Dave did Bill Wendell's open announce. Dave was staying there at 11:30. So they cut in my, and that's what happened. And they went to Hicks. I mean, you know, people were wrong. I don't think that he was told the truth, Hicks, but I think they also were very anxious to get him back on the show soon.
What was the reason?
I think the reason was that we were only on the air for 5 weeks, and we just did not, the show just did not want all this controversy. So
from early, the Christians.
Well, I think it was, I think there were a couple, yeah, or whatever it was. They just thought, they just didn't want to take that on.
The Christian right might have reacted.
Yeah, right. And they just did not want that. But they told him, they said, listen, this is our fault because the set should have been better produced and there's other stuff and this and that. And we're going to have you on real soon. But nobody knew he was sick. Nobody knew he was dying. And so, of course, that's what happened. And I think Bill kind of ran with it. I don't think that, I don't think that he was, I think that he was really hurt. And
probably because he knew it might have been one of his last sets on that show.
1,000. Absolutely. And so that happened, and then it was it became a mystery over all of these. And back then we had these huge monster ratings, and of course, nobody ever knew that it was me that went on. And then I don't know how many years later Dave had his mother on.
I know. I was going to ask you about that. That was
really something. That was Dave's decision.
Was it eating at him?
Yes.
It must have been.
It was. And
that's like, how many years later is more than a decade?
Oh, absolutely. It was. And Bill Hicks's mom said to him, I knew once you had a son that you would come. She said this to him.
Did she say that on the air?
Yes.
I can't remember. Yeah.
And he righted the wrong. Now, I don't know anything that's going on. I never do. I just work on my little.
He didn't run the set, though. It would have been interesting. No one's seen that.
Yes, they did.
They did run it?
They ran it that night.
Oh, good. Okay.
And Dave says, I'm embarrassed because this stuff is as funny now as it was then. And for me to think that was controversial and I'm embarrassed. No, they ran it. They ran the whole set. Now, just because, you know, I'm here, I'll just tell you about me. I had no idea that Hicks's mother was going to be on until the day before, and I didn't think anything of it. And then, of course, I relived all this, and I felt awful that I was cut in because I was friends with him. But Colleen said he was thrilled it was you. I felt very guilty, but even though it was not my decision. And I went up to Hicks's mother like I came up to you after she finished, and I said, hi, my name is Bill Sheff. She said, I know who you are. And she said, Bill was very fond of you. And of course, it was everything I could do not to break down and cry because, you know, but I was, I like to think that maybe it was some closure for everybody on that. But that's what happened.
Mm.
That's what happened. And I'm sorry that it got... that it went sideways and he became this sort of censored, persecuted, a martyr. And it was, to me as a comic, it was a set that was just not well produced.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not well thought out. And it was not, he didn't close with his strongest
right
bit.
It was a bunch of events. It was a new show. They didn't want controversy,
right,
and it wasn't as strong a set.
Right.
And the fact that he passed away so shortly after, you know, sort of, you know, amplified.
Well, they did I find two things interesting. They did a documentary many, many years ago, and Dave was on, and he said, well, he was a favorite of ours,
yeah,
and his last appearance on our show was made more odd by the circumstances of the fact that he never got back on. And the thing that I found amazing is there've been many books written about Hicks, many books written about this night. And of all those books, I was only interviewed once. And because I didn't give play to the narrative,
yeah,
it was really never run in that book.
Mm-hmm. What, in Kevin's or Cynthia's?
I think Cynthia, yeah.
She didn't interview.
She interviewed me.
Right.
She interviewed me.
But Kevin didn't.
Yeah. And because I wasn't, yeah, man. He was, you know, it was, you know, the people and he was,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
The set shouldn't have been.
Man shut him down.
Yeah. And so that was, but that was it. But I'm glad I got the chance to tell that story. You know, there's a guy, he's a newspaper writer and he's a musician in North Carolina named John Dawson. And he says, you know what I like about Bill Hicks is there's this guy and he's saying these brilliant things and these deep things and these hilarious things. And he sounds like me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the thing about Hicks that...
Hey, he was great.
Yeah.
And he was a good guy.
He was a great guy.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Bill, and good luck with the book. It was a great talk.
Well, I loved it, and you know, God bless you for having me out here, and it's always, I love talking about stand-up, because, you know, stand-ups, if you get two guys at an airport that have never met, two comics, and there's a three-hour layover, and they find out they're both comics, that 3 hours just flies right?
Yeah, never.
This guy's a scumbag, and this guy screwed me. Yeah.
Did you see that one guy, what he did?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great talking to you.
Thanks so much.
That's cool. That was a good conversation. I like talking to that guy. What else? Go to WTFpod.com. Get the app if you want. Upload the app for free. Then upgrade to premium. Get all the fucking episodes. Get all those fucking episodes. Leave a comment. Buy some merch. Christmas is coming up. I got no plan for this. Rest in peace, Hubert Sumlin. I know it's been a while, but yeah. Boomer lives!